Thanks very much. I'm going to be talking this morning mostly about the global economic outlook. This is actually the fifth year that I've spoken at this CEDA event, and it's certainly the toughest year for the global economy that we've seen during that time. Economic events around the world have moved very quickly over the past few months. We've known for some time that a significant downturn was occurring in the major industrial economies as they felt the effects of the financial crisis. But for much of last year, other parts of the world were looking quite resilient. China and the other developing economies in Asia and elsewhere mostly kept growing at a good pace up until the September quarter. And world commodity prices up to that point were still close to their peaks. But the period since then has seen a sharp deterioration in conditions. The downturn in the G7 economies intensified in the December quarter, and at the same time it spread to other parts of the world, including Asia, Latin America and Eastern Europe. For the world economy as a whole, 2009 is shaping up as a very difficult year. IMF forecasts released in late January are for world growth of 0.5% this year, with the G7 economies contracting by 2%. If these forecasts are realised, it will amount to the weakest year for the global economy and for the advanced industrial economies in the post-war period. Two things stand out as being quite remarkable about the recent sequence of events. One is the abrupt nature of the deterioration. The graph that we're looking at here shows the sequence of forecasts for the G7 economies and for the world as a whole as they were made over the course of the past year. As recently as July last year, the IMF were forecasting world growth of 3.9%, which would have been close to its long-run average. A downward revision to the world outlook by more than 3 percentage points over the 6 months since then is, to my knowledge, unprecedented. And much of that revision has taken place within the last 3 months. I make these observations not as a criticism of forecasters, but just as an indication of how quickly the momentum of the world economy was changing during this period. For the G7 economies, the shift was almost as pronounced, from a forecast of +1 to -2 over the same period. The other notable feature is the highly synchronised nature of the current downturn. We can illustrate that by looking at the proportion of Australia's trading partners that are growing at rates of growth significantly below trend. It's worth noting here that the 4-year period up to 2007 was itself highly unusual in that none of Australia's major trading partners fell into that category during that period. In contrast, growth in virtually all of Australia's trading partners will be well below trend this year if official forecasts are realised. This would also mean that the current cycle is more highly synchronised than the 3 previous international recessions in the early 80s, the early 90s, and in 2001. The trigger for this rapid downgrading of the international outlook has been the flow of very weak data coming from around the world in the past few months, pertaining mainly to the December quarter. Preliminary estimates are that the US economy contracted by 1% in the quarter, having posted only a small fall in the previous quarter and moderate growth over the year prior to that. Consumer spending and business investment both weakened noticeably, and the housing sector, has been an ongoing drag on activity for some time. Job losses accelerated in the quarter to more than 500,000 a month. Similar patterns are being seen in a number of the other advanced economies. GDP in both the UK and the euro area fell by 1.5% in the quarter. And we learned earlier this week that Japanese GDP fell by more than 3%. Across the Asian region in particular, a number of countries experienced unusually sharp falls in measures of output and international trade during this period. In Japan, for example, industrial production fell by 20% over the final 3 months of the year, as did the volume of exports. Similar movements occurred across the smaller economies in the region. China's GDP continued to grow in the quarter, but at a much reduced pace. Clearly, then, the deterioration in global conditions in the December quarter was both abrupt and widespread. So what caused it? I suggest three main factors were at work. The first was a widespread loss of confidence in the wake of the collapse of the US investment bank Lehman Brothers, which occurred on 15 September last year. You'll recall that this was a period of exceptional turmoil in global financial markets. The Lehman collapse itself followed the effective nationalisation of the US federal mortgage agencies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, a week earlier. These events were then followed in quick succession by the nationalisation of the US insurer AIG, and then by a string of other announcements of failure or near failure of financial institutions both in the United States and Europe. Uncertainty about the nature and scope of various rescue packages proposed through this period added to the general turmoil. And it was during this period that a number of governments around the world moved to guarantee deposits in their banking systems. One indicator of the way these events affected confidence is the reaction of equity markets. In the 3 months following the Lehman collapse, world equity prices recorded some of their largest daily movements in both directions in history. In net terms, equity prices in the major economies fell by around 30% in that time. They have, however, fluctuated around a more stable average since then. Survey-based measures of business and consumer confidence also fell sharply in the major economies. It seems plausible that improvements in communication technology and the more rapid transmission of economic news have contributed to making these swings in confidence more highly synchronised around the world than they were in the past. In any case, it's clear that conditions were generally weakening already from around mid-2008, but they took a sharp turn for the worse in the period immediately after the Lehman's collapse. Households and businesses around the world seem to have made a rapid re-evaluation of their spending plans, and in particular, they cut back on their discretionary spending. One very clear example of that was a sharp drop in the demand for cars in the final months of 2008. This resulted in car sales in the major economies falling from their early 2008 levels by around 25%. A second causal factor also related to the Lehman's collapse is likely to have been a further tightening of credit standards in the major economies. This is recorded, for example, in surveys of lending institutions, as shown here. The tightening of credit standards showed itself, among other things, in disruptions to trade credit and insurance, and in a general tightening of lending for consumer and business spending in the major economies. Thirdly, these effects seem to have been transmitted very quickly around the world through international trade linkages, as businesses cut back on production in response to reduced orders. Falls in exports and production were particularly pronounced for cars, for steel, and for electronics. There were probably also some internal cyclical dynamics in some countries that amplified all of these effects. In China, for example, the economy had for some time been growing at a faster-than-trend pace, and the authorities there had been taking steps to rein in growth during 2007 and the first half of 2008. With external demand falling away, there seems to have been a build-up of inventories in China, and that prompted a sharp adjustment to production volumes late last year. More generally, firms around the world probably sought to economise on their inventories around that time in response to weaker expected demand and reduced availability of working capital. It seems likely that the contraction in global activity seen in the December quarter contained a significant one-off element. Businesses and consumers made a big adjustment to their spending levels in response to the shock to confidence, and businesses cut production and inventories in response to the fall in demand and tighter credit. It's too early to tell, though, what the trends in demand and activity will look like as we emerge from this period. We just don't have sufficient data to get a good reading on that yet. What we do know is that economic downturns don't last forever. So, despite the gloomy circumstances that I've just described, it's important to ask the question, what are the factors that can contribute to an upturn in due course? I've given you three factors that contributed to the recent deterioration, so let me counterbalance that with three factors that over time can be expected to contribute to an upturn. The first factor is the substantial set of expansionary measures that have been taken through conventional monetary and fiscal policies. Interest rates have been cut to very low levels in most countries, and there are some very large fiscal policy initiatives in the pipeline around the world. In a number of countries, including the United States and China, discretionary fiscal expansions of the order of 2% of GDP look like being implemented in 2009 on top of the working of the automatic stabilisers. Secondly, the major economies have taken a range of steps to provide direct assistance to their financial sectors. And these have taken several forms, including central bank actions to improve access to liquidity, direct injections of capital into financial institutions, and the provision of government guarantees. Probably more needs to be done in the major countries on this front, but there are some tentative signs at least that these steps are contributing to some improvement in the functioning of financial markets. The extreme volatility that followed the Lehman's collapse has eased off in the last couple of months, and the availability of government guarantees has seen a recovery of bond issuance by banks around the world. This in turn is helping to put banks in a position where they can be more confident of their sources of long-term funding. My third point is that the normal cyclical dynamics of the global economy can eventually be expected to run their course. By this I mean several things. The destocking that typically occurs in the early stages of an economic downturn is essentially a limited phenomenon. It only needs to happen once. Similarly, where overbuilding has occurred, it will take some time for the accumulated oversupply to run off, but eventually the growth of underlying demand will reassert itself. We're seeing that mechanism gradually playing out, for example, in the US housing sector, where the fall in housing starts has meant that excess stocks of new homes are now being wound back. And that's an essential precondition for eventual recovery in that sector. Other cyclical forces will work through asset and credit markets. During a generalised loss of confidence, a range of markets, including those for equities, for housing, and for commodities, can often overshoot on the downside. But at some point, they'll reach a level that's sufficiently cheap to encourage investors back into the market. I can't say whether they might be close to that point yet, but it is encouraging that both equities and commodity prices have been more stable in the last couple of months after the sharp falls that were seen in the December quarter. These various mechanisms work on different time frames. A conventional inventory cycle might be quite short. At the other end of the scale, experience suggests that balance sheet repair can take considerable time. Nonetheless, governments around the world are taking significant steps to speed up the process, and various further proposals to take bad assets off the balance sheets of troubled institutions are still being considered. Let me conclude with a few remarks about what all this means for Australia. There are reasons to expect that the Australian economy can continue to perform better than its overseas counterparts in the difficult period that lies ahead. Australia had more momentum than most comparable economies in the period leading into the crisis. As in other countries, substantial monetary and fiscal measures have been taken to support growth. But an important difference is that the Australian financial system remains in much better shape than its international counterparts. As a result of that, we've been able to gain much more traction from cuts in official interest rate. In the period since the RBA started cutting the cash rate in September, substantial cuts have been passed through to end borrowers, particularly for housing loans. This is in marked contrast to other countries where banks have been more heavily affected by financial strains, and the degree of pass-through has, as a result, been much more limited. Another factor helping to insulate the domestic economy from events abroad is the depreciation of the exchange rate. Having said all that, there's no doubt that Australia will be operating in a difficult international environment this year. Official forecasts, including those of the IMF, imply that output in the major industrial economies will contract further in the first half of this year, but start to pick up later in the year and into 2010. The situation is still highly uncertain, but for the reasons I've been outlining, that seems like a reasonable expectation for the global economy. Thanks very much.
So, do I have any questions before I get some more information out of them on interest rates? What I did want to ask, though, is I guess when we are also economically literate, or we assume that we're economically literate, is this part of the problem? The fact that we are now all reading the business pages and that we have these headlines and our news organisations do have a fair amount now of economic reporting. Are we getting too much information? Is that really part of the problem with confidence that you mentioned earlier?
Well, I could comment on that. I did make a comment about that in my remarks earlier, and I think the rapid flow of information has been a factor that contributed to the very highly synchronised loss of confidence around the world. Probably the main effect of that was the synchronisation rather than the severity of it, so I don't want to make too much of that, and I think it would be silly to say that people shouldn't get the information about what's happening. But I think just the way that the turmoil and the news associated with that spread around the world is an explanatory factor for why things turned down in such a synchronised way around the world in the December quarter.
But if we've got so much information, if we've got so much information, how come it all went so wrong when the people who were driving it clearly had much more than we've got?
Well, I think what went wrong, you have to trace back a lot further than what happened in the December quarter itself. I mean, there was a long period of build-up of financial imbalances, which reached a point where it all began to unravel, and that's been happening over the last, I guess, almost 2 years now. That's been happening, but that unravelling process really accelerated towards the end of last year, as some of the major financial institutions in the US and Europe started to come unstuck, and governments had to scramble to work out how they were going to respond to that, and it all became a major source of uncertainty. So I don't think that either too much or too little information is the problem. I think that what we're seeing is that periodically you get these periods of financial overstretch where people borrow too much money, financial institutions take decisions that with hindsight turn out to have been reckless, they take too much risk. It's very hard to stand against the mentality that leads to that when it's happening, because everybody's making money and they feel that therefore what they're doing must be based on sound decision-making principles. But we've seen, I would say, roughly once a decade in recent decades, periods where you get these build-ups of imbalances, too much risk being taken, and then you get the unravelling occurring. And the one that we're seeing at the moment is the most severe of those episodes that we've had in recent times. Mm.
Do we have any questions for our... I just want to ask... Oh, sorry, this gentleman here.
Thank you. Stuart McQuarrie, Evans and Peck. A question for David Pearce. David, in the light of the GFC, do you think there'll be a change in the number of emission permits put on the market by the government, or is this just a blip?
It's hard to know. I there's not any signals at the moment that the short-term target that they've advertised, 5% reduction by 2020, is going to change. They may do. I think the interesting thing that I didn't mention is that things like the global financial crisis really teach us some lessons about how to construct a robust climate policy. Because this shock could have come along, you know, 2 years after we'd started emissions trading, for example. I mean, it happens to have come along prior. And one of the problems is that some forms of global policy, in particular global cap and trade type policies, are not very robust to shocks like the financial crisis. So it turns out when you do some, again, it's only modelling, but when you do some modelling, global cap and trade schemes tend to transmit all the worst things about a financial crisis. And when it's a good thing, they don't tend to transmit the good things. So my reaction to the GFC is to say there'll be another one in the course of our mitigation policies, almost certainly. I mean, I've said that these policies have to, you know, have to be going for 100 years before they have any effect. So there'll be another crisis, financial crisis of some sort. So we really need to think about what are the lessons for the clever design of a mitigation policy that are robust, or as robust as you can get, to a financial crisis. And I think that's something that's really only starting to seep through both the profession of economics and the design of these things and the policy making. So we may see some changes in thinking about designs in the medium term.
Thank you. This gentleman over here. We do have somebody there, with his microphone.
Rachel Merton, KPMG. Following the GFC and sort of continued discussion about what the likely regulatory response might be, and on one hand we have, the Australian government and regulators, you know, saying that this has been a good test of Australia's regulatory system, and an international regulators, you know, should take note. And then I guess on the other hand, it's still a little bit unclear as to what sort of further regulatory reform may be embarked on in response. So, yeah, Malcolm or Rob?
Okay. I think the Australian regulatory system does come out of this looking extremely good. And it's interesting to note when Ben Bernanke a few months ago was hauled before Congress and was asked, you know, that exact question almost, what would you do to change the regulatory system in America to prevent this happening again? The sort of model he outlined was so parallel to the one that we've actually got in Australia, had in place for Australia for half a decade, I was quite amazed. And he was basically talking about a very similar regulatory regime to the one we have. So I think it has held us in good stead. Part of it is that it's not constant, it's evolving. And I think that's important. One of the things Bernanke has said again is that the problem with the American system is it was archaic. It needed overhauling and hadn't been overhauled for quite some time. So, you know, the evolution of our system, I think, has been part of its advantage. But I guess I can sit here now and say, you know, in all honesty, that the strength of the regulatory system, which is often a burden, by the way, to banks like NAB, has meant that we now have banks which are, I think at the moment there are 13 banks in the world with a AA credit rating. Four of them are the Australian majors. I mean, that is an amazing position for Australia to be in. And it's no coincidence. It's because of the regulatory framework under which the banks operate in Australia. So I do think that a lot of overseas regulators and policymakers, governments, will be looking at models like the one we've had in Australia. I'm not saying that, you know, there isn't opportunities for refinement here, but I think, you know, we've got the bare bones of what will become the accepted model globally.
This gentleman here in blue shirt.
Matt Cooper from Energy Australia. David, you mentioned about the role of markets in responding to this challenge of climate change and climate policy. In the modelling that's been done, what's your view on the scope for technological improvement and the sorts of investment that are going to be required to actually result in maybe the cost of mitigation being less than forecast?
I think the interesting thing about mitigation policy and the reason why we like to use markets is that we need to discover some things that we don't know at the moment. Right? So we don't really know until we start what the medium and to long-term cost of mitigation are. Markets are particularly good at discovering new information, new ways of doing things, new technologies. When I talk to engineers, which as I do every now and then, I tell them that the entire purpose of an emissions trading scheme is to make them more creative. The entire point is to make engineers more creative. So I think actually there is enormous scope for market-based incentives to allow people to discover new information, things that we don't know. And that's why I think that over the long term, the cost will probably be a lot lower than we currently expect, because we will discover things that we don't know now. The problem with modelling is that all we can put into the models is what we know at the moment. And in the Treasury modelling, for example, there's cost curves for various kinds of abatement in the aluminium sector, in the steel sector, you know, the cost of carbon capture and storage and so on. And at the moment, a lot of industry people think that that's too optimistic. But I suspect that over the longer term, we will discover many, many new ways of doing things. There's a problem in this area is that people tend to focus on one or two big ticket items that you can get your head around, like carbon capture and storage. You know, it's a big thing, you can understand, you capture the carbon dioxide, you stick it in some stable form and you put it underground or whatever. People want to focus on big single items that are going to be, you know, the solution, as it were. In actual fact, I think the solution will come from literally thousands and thousands of small adjustments, a lot of which we can't predict. I mean, we're only starting to understand, you know, the potentials for biological-based sequestration in Australia, which is huge potential but totally unexplored and not scientifically understood yet. So I think that over the long term, as long as we have lots of incentives going out there and we don't think it's the job of the government to plan the energy sector, then we will... And other sectors that emit, then we will discover new technologies that, as I said, I think will be lower cost in the long run than we expect. The problem is, in the short term, there's a big transition, big transfers of capital losses for people with old technologies, and managing that process is going to be a major political challenge. And there's a risk that if that's more costly than we expect, it will derail the overall objectives of the policy. So that's something we've got to watch out for.
Yes.
Rory McLeod from Colliers International. A question for Malcolm Eadie. The global financial boom and crisis has been a relatively recent and short-term phenomenon, say, over the last 5 years. And I think that overlays a couple of decades of strong growth that we've seen in the world economy, mainly driven through the growth of the American economy and consumption there as the baby boomers aged and spent and consumed. What we're seeing now is an ageing of the population in America, and the growth rates looking forward of American consumption compared to the last couple of decades are likely to be a lot lower. So is this current situation that we're seeing in the global financial crisis really just a veneer over a structural shift that's occurring, such as we're seeing an example in Japan over the last decade, where the economy's been flat because of such low domestic demand growth?
Well, I think that the demographic forces that you're talking about do gradually work to slow growth in the major industrial economies to the extent that they're not offset by higher productivity growth or increased worker participation or increased immigration from the developing world. But at the same time, you have to remember that there's another transformation going on in other parts of the world, especially China and India, which are growing, up until the the effects of this current crisis have been growing at extremely high rates. They've got plenty of scope to continue to do that for a long time. We saw, for example, the Japanese growth model, or South Korea was another example of this. They were able to grow at rates of the order of 10% per annum for decades, simply because of the fact that they were a long way behind the technological frontier, and you get those sort of growth rates as you're catching up. Now, China and India and other parts of the developing world have got a long way to go in that catch-up process, and as they catch up, they're becoming a bigger and bigger proportion of the world economy as well, and so that's a very powerful force that works in the direction of increasing global growth prospects. So I would still say that if we think about the sorts of forces that we thought were going to be important for Australia in the long run, and we talked about this a lot a year ago, that there's huge demand for the resource commodities that Australia produces, which is going to be very good for Australian incomes. I think that force will still continue to operate in the long run, but we're seeing quite a severe short-term effect from the global financial crisis that is working against that at the moment. I think the other thing to say is that the reason why Japan has slowed down over the decades since the 1970s, it is partly demographics, but it's also partly because Japan succeeded in largely catching up to the developed world, and so the potential for catch-up growth was no longer there. But that's not the case for China and India and the rest.
Thank you. There's a gentleman at the back there.
Warren Riddell. This is a question for the panel generally. I understand that Australia's probably got the fourth largest pool of superannuation funds globally. Just wonder what the panel's view was on how relevant that pool is to the overall recovery.
Could you repeat the question, please? I'm not sure how relevant it was, did you say?
Yes, given the fact that Australia has probably the fourth largest pool of superannuation funds globally, which makes it very significant globally in terms of a pool of capital, to what extent is that relevant in the process moving forward of actually bringing a recovery to the global financial crisis, not just in Australia, but also internationally?
Who wants to take that one?
That's an interesting question. I guess in terms of the current macro situation, it's in a way it's a side issue, and I think it's a very important issue. But in terms of macro management, the outlook, that growth in that savings pool will more or less continue inexorably as the recession progresses, the slowdown, whatever we have in our forecast, progresses and the recovery comes forward. So to me, it's much more of a structural thing in our economy rather than something which is a driver of what's happening here. I guess the way I look at it is, though, probably to an extent, the point Malcolm made and I too made about the impact on confidence of the news about the global financial crisis. Now, I reckon that because so many Australians now have compulsory superannuation, many more of them are aware what's happening in the stock market. So, the indirect wealth effects of a major downturn in global stock markets on confidence and then on spending by consumers must be becoming more important in Australia, because everybody knows what the price of BHP or Rio or Woolworths or DJs is these days. I'm astounded at how many people can quote the numbers better than I can. So, I think that's important for confidence, but it does kind of underline the point Malcolm made about the speed of which the herd can get running, if you like. The stampede can occur. On a bigger picture story, though, I think that Australia is actually in a very good position in a structural sense. Part of the reason why our fiscal outlook is so positive is because the government has now put aside money for its public servant superannuation. We're all paying for our own. We don't have a big call on the government's purse, or as big as it would have been. So that means there is a bit more flexibility in fiscal policy, if you like. So from that perspective, it's probably a very positive thing as well. They're just sort of some ideas around what you asked. I hope gives some idea.
Yeah. Rob, do you think? Sorry, just a thought that, given that people were aware very much of their super funds and they were aware of stock prices going up, and there was a view that, you know, we're going to get 20% returns, 30, you know, big returns inevitably. People have discovered, well, that's not true. Are they going to pay a lot more attention now to what their fund managers are doing? I mean, is there a lot more discipline now on fund managers to really pay attention and not just run with the index?
Well, you'd hope it would. I guess the trouble that I find with the current superannuation arrangements is, though, that they're almost impossible to understand. So, you know, I mean, I don't know anybody that doesn't... that's got a significant amount of superannuation that doesn't take regular advice. And it's not advice about the investments that they make, it's about the structuring in tax and that sort of thing that they need to do for their superannuation. So I think we've still got a long way to go in terms of the, you know, reducing the opaqueness of the whole system. But yeah, I mean, I do think, and I hope it means that people will realise that entrusting your money to somebody and just letting them run with it, it's not necessarily what you should do. You should actually pay more attention to how much they've got in equities and how much they've got in property and how much they've got in cash, and do they really want to have so much money in stock markets when, you know, they're clearly gaining, getting near a peak or have started to turn. So I think that's an interesting observation, David.
I'm afraid we're going to have just one last question, and this is down the front here.
From Dick Warburton and O'Connell Street Associates for David Pearce. David, in the adaptation you mentioned, you asked the question, do we really believe the science? Could you elaborate on that, and what are the ramifications if we got the science wrong?
It's true to say I think the science is, of course, subject to considerable uncertainty. So any, it's very hard to make hard and fast statements about the science. When you read this, I'm not a scientist, but I've spent a lot of time crawling through obscure articles in Science and Nature and so on. Scientists are always very careful to put probability distributions around things and uncertainty bounds, much more so than when their stuff is translated into the public domain. So there is a huge amount of uncertainty underlying the science. I mean, I guess the main view is that, look, it could be that climate change is a mild and gradual thing, something that we can gradually adapt to. I mean, our farming sector is very used to adapting to small changes. And if it's like that, then it's not such a big problem. We can afford to start slow with regards to policy and adaptation and ramp up gradually. But what they're saying is that there is a risk, and it's not a certainty, but it's a risk, and it may be very low probability risk, but it's a risk of a substantive change to the climate. I mean, a low risk of a very, very, very high increase in average temperatures, for example. And that's not smooth. You know, it's not a nice smooth probability distribution. It's got this so-called long tail or fat tail or whatever you want to call it, like a low risk but of something very, very, very bad. And I guess what the science is saying is that there's a strong insurance argument for making both adaptation and mitigation measures. Now, as with any insurance, it may turn out to have been a waste of money. I mean, you insure your car every year, hopefully it's a waste of money every year because nothing happens to your car. So it's really the insurance, we have to think about this as in an insurance and probabilistic sense. So if the science is wrong and we go about particularly undertaking very costly mitigation measures, then we would have wasted our money, just like insurance, in a sense. But that's only true after the event. You don't know that. And then maybe we'll look back in 50 or 100 years' time and say, well, thank goodness we made that bet. I mean, when you know, each year I'm sure you're happy that you've taken car insurance, even though nothing happens. So there's a probability that, you know, we'll do the wrong thing and it will be unnecessarily costly. It's really a matter of your views about, or the community's views about, how much downside or upside risk are they willing to take.
Can I just add, I mean, another way that I look at this particular issue is that, I mean, I work for a bank, and the main thing that banks sell is basically risk management. And I guess the defining moment for me in the climate change debate came when I was working with a group of economists who were trying to put a letter together about, you know, what should be done about the potential for climate change. And we all sort of came to the conclusion that if this sort of a risk was facing our businesses, i.e., you know, big banks in this, big and medium-sized international banks in the Australian economy at the moment, there's no way you'd let that risk go through without introducing some form of risk management to make sure that you had the potential for that risk covered. So the way you would do that would be to set up a mechanism to manage that risk, and hopefully, as David's implying, something with low cost at the start. But at least then you'd have the mechanism in place so that if it turned out that the risk was actually much larger than you initially thought, you could ramp it up quickly. On the other hand, if it turned out it was unnecessary insurance, as David put it, then you could actually wind it back with limited costs. So in a way, I think the current government's approach here is quite reasonable from that perspective. They're putting in place a market-based mechanism to deal with the problem, but if you actually look at the cost they're talking about, you know, it's relatively minor. And I know that, you know, there'll be screams for some people it's not minor, but when I see the exchange rate going from 98 cents to 60 cents in the space of less than 12 months, I mean, the cost that that imposes potentially on tradable industries in Australia is just out of the top of the graph compared to the cost we're talking about in climate change over a period from, you know, now to 2020 under the government's current arrangements. And it seems to me that, you know, that's about the right balance. Get the mechanism in place, make the cost low at the start, let the science do its work and see whether we need to adjust it down the track, up or down.